From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd in Phoenix.
I'm Miles Parks in Washington, D.C. It's Here and Now. The new report on the Uvalde school shooting from a Texas legislative committee details the failure of the law enforcement response to the mass shooter. But it also points out that people miss signs that this was a young person thinking about committing violence. Texas State Representative Joe Moody, who served on the committee, spoke with NPR's Steve Inskeep this morning.
This is someone who is on, multiple platforms, becomes a running joke calling him a school shooter on those platforms. None of those people made any sorts of reports, even though he made no secret of the fact that he was fascinated with school shootings.
Well, thankfully, sometimes people do come forward to report a potential shooting before it happens. And on occasion, it is the parents who might see something like a journal entry that details plans for an attack. When that happens, it can be an agonizing decision to report your own child to the police. The Wall Street Journal's Tonnell Hobbs spoke with parents who did exactly that. Tonnell, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you.
So why don't we start with a woman named Alania Vasquez, who decided that she would report her 14-year-old son to police, essentially hoping that he could get some help. What did she see that prompted her to call police?
You know, he's had, since he was 3 years old, she had noticed that he had some, mental issues as far as acting out, reacting overboard to situations. So she's had him in counseling just for years. But in these later years, when he was 14, even before turning 14, she had just noticed that he had this obsession with mass shooters, an obsession with violence. Just really couldn't stop talking about it, obsessed with guns, and just making threats at school. And she just got so concerned where she felt, I need to report him, because she feared that he could get around a like-minded person that would provide him a weapon and that he would go do harm likely at a school.
And then what happened when she did report it?
You know, she actually really did want him to get the help. And obviously she wanted to protect the public too. But she didn't realize that he would be charged with a felony. But he got some help. He didn't get the intensive help that she wanted, not right away anyway. But what she had to do was basically say, my child is a danger, and here's what's going on with my child. And that was the way that she did get something done. But it was a hard choice to make.
No, I can only imagine. Yes. And it's a choice that, it turns out not many parents are making, and we don't know exactly why, but there's a recent study by the Center for Targeted Violence Prevention that found most of the time it's either the fellow students or the staff at a school who are warning authorities ahead of time, and it's only parents who are stopping a potential attack just about 4% of the time. So what does that tell you about the challenges that parents are facing here?
Right. And that's what law enforcement and professionals, counselors, that's the percentage that they point to, because they feel like with parents, living in the household and being in the position to observe, that they would think that the 4% of cases that they felt were averted by someone telling, that number would be higher than 4% for parents.
Mm. Well, we should point out that Alania Vasquez is not alone, and I think that anyone who's ever tried to find a good therapist for their kids knows something about this, at least in some small way.
Right.
What did you learn about how hard it is to find mental health care for kids before it ever gets to this point where there's a threat that's imminent?
Yeah, I was really astounded all that Alania Vasquez had done to try to get him help. And he needed more than just, popping into the counselor every now and then. He was at the point where he really did need that, intensive in-house long-term care. And that's what she was having problems getting. It got worse and worse every year. And her fear was that, oh my God, well, I don't want my child to be the next school shooter.
Tonnell, as a parent, I can't help but put myself in the shoes of these moms and dads who are making this tough decision. And I think one of the reasons that it must be so hard is that even if you do get your kid help, and it seems like Alania Vasquez eventually did, and even if you stop an attack, your relationship with your kid might forever be changed. So I guess my question for you is how her son is doing and how they are doing together.
Yeah, that's a great question. And that is a fear. And from my interviews with parents, that happens that even to this day, even after a couple years after the report was made to police, their children still feel like that was unnecessary, especially if they have a criminal record. They really are still angry about that. For Alana and her son, their relationship is still strained. And when I talk to her son, he still just can't understand why his mother needed to get police involved. And he's still angry about that.
So would you say that she's at peace with her decision?
Oh, yeah. She has no regrets. She doesn't know how far it would have went. And obviously, when the police got involved and they searched his room, they found his journal that was very detailed on him wanting to, you know, he'd made threats to kill his mother, her boyfriend, and then go and kill everyone at the school and then kill himself. And so she really believes she did the right thing. She believes that she could have averted a school shooting. And she just felt it was a matter of time before her son could have gotten a weapon somehow and acted out what he wrote in his journal.
Tonnell Hobbs is a senior special writer on the investigations team at the Wall Street Journal. We'll link you to her piece at hereandnow.org. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
To Ukraine now, where Russia has ramped up what appear to be deliberate missile attacks on civilians. Russian officials claim they are precision strikes on military targets. NPR's Jason Bobian reports from Ukraine on what may be behind those attacks.
It was a hot summer afternoon. Ihor Mikhailov and his wife decided to go into the Amstor shopping mall here in Kremenchuk to get out of the sun and buy some water. Minutes later, a Soviet-era missile crashed into the complex. Mikhailov's wife and 20 other people were killed.
When I woke up, I realized I'd lost my arm. There were blocks of concrete that had fallen around me. I was lying under them. I realized I had to crawl out of there.
The 53-year-old construction worker is one of nearly 60 people seriously injured in the blast. Russian officials initially claimed that the mall was empty and the casualties staged. The mall is adjacent to a large factory, Kredmash, which makes paving equipment. Moments after the first strike, a second missile hit the industrial complex.
So here is the place where the missile hit.
Viktor Shubko is the deputy head of the plant. The strike occurred after most of the workers had left for the day. It injured two security guards, damaged one assembly line, and blew out a lot of windows. Moscow claims Ukraine was using this factory to hide weapons. Shubko laughs when asked about this, saying he heard this rumor too from Russian media.
So you can see overall our storage is open, so you can see that there is no place to keep any kind of military machines here.
Yet, this is a massive industrial complex. It covers nearly 60 acres. The compound is a collection of warehouses and metalworking factories with direct access to rail lines and truck loading docks. It certainly has the potential to hide weapons. Retired Lieutenant General Ben Hodges, the former head of the U.S. Army in Europe, says the plant appears to have been the intended target. Russia is desperate, he says, to stop Western military supplies from reaching the front lines in the east.
You know, they have not been able to in any way effectively disrupt the logistical network inside Ukraine. So all the ammunition, the equipment that the West is providing, it's largely been undisrupted.
Moscow, however, has burned through the bulk of its precision missiles, he says. So the Russians are now using missiles built 40 years ago that lack sophisticated targeting systems. Russia doesn't have the ability to strike moving trains or trucks inside Ukraine, Hodges says. So they're going after suspected weapons warehouses and transfer points.
I mean, the Russian Air Force does not even come into Ukrainian airspace because they have failed to achieve air superiority. They're terrified of Ukrainian Air Force and air defense.
And so they launch missiles from hundreds of miles away. If they end up killing innocent bystanders, Hodges says this plays into Russia's scorched earth policy. They try to terrify the local population, he adds, to undercut Ukrainian support for the war.
That's what this is about. And so how do you achieve maximum terror? You hit a shopping mall at peak hours.
Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky denounced the strike on the mall as a war crime. Oleksandra Matvishuk, the head of the Center for Civil Liberties Ukraine, agrees. She says it's irrelevant if Russian commanders believed they were aiming for military targets.
You have always to evaluate the possible damage for civilians, even when you try to hit a military object.
Russia routinely isn't doing that evaluation, she says. Hodges, the retired lieutenant general, says he expects Russian strikes on civilians to continue and maybe even increase as military leaders in Moscow grow more frustrated with what they expected to be a quick war. Jason Beaubien, NPR News, Kremenchuk, Ukraine.
Our next guest is only 16 years old, but when she plays her banjo and sings, Nora Brown is an old soul. That's from Nora's 2021 Tiny Desk Concert for NPR. Next week, the music prodigy turns 17, and next month, she releases her third album. This one is called Long Time to Be Gone. Here's the first single off that album.
Under my bed, you can set your little satchel. On my hand, you'll lay your hand.
Song is called Little Satchel, and Nora Brown joins me now from New York City. Nora, what a treat. Welcome.
Thank you so much. I'm so glad to be here.
Well, we're glad to have you. And look, I don't want to dwell on your age, but it is kind of hard to ignore. You are so young. You've already accomplished so much. What's driving you to do this when you could be out doing what all the other 16-year-olds are doing?
Yeah, well, honestly, it's kind of a tricky one because I started so young, and at 6 years old, I wasn't like, oh my God, I love old-time traditional music. I mean, obviously, I did enjoy playing it, but that wasn't necessarily something that came out of my mouth. But something that definitely drives me is the stories that it holds and the kind of time capsule quality that it has, where you play a song and it completely connects you to an entirely different time period and also like a specific story or instance that you could have never experienced, but you have this little capsule of it. And I also really enjoy the fact that you can kind of express yourself individually, but at the same time draw from the playing of others and kind of express yourself through music that's been created by those before you. And I feel like that's something that you can't really find in a lot of other musical spaces.
Yeah. So let's hear you play just a little bit more. This is a classic. This is Cumberland Gap. That's as well known as it is. Do you try to put your own approach on it, your own spin?
Yeah, well, that's an interesting question, because that's something that's a big part of my playing, and I think a big part of traditional music in general. It's often the case that, you know, when you learn from somebody solely by ear and don't have this kind of a written copy of that music, it's bound to change, not always purposely, although sometimes it's also creates a space where you're able to purposely alter music, which is kind of cool too. And that's, I both unconsciously and consciously change.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Unconsciously. I wonder if you have a theory about where that comes from inside of you. It's almost like a fingerprint, right?
Yeah, it's sort of interesting. In school, I actually ended up doing a research project about the folk process and about how music changes and kind of what that has to do with how we learn it. And old-time music, the community that it creates, often can be a really welcoming community for personal and self-expression, because there's like not often like a lot of songs being written. You know, people need an outlet for their own kind of artistic touch, you know, and I think that that's kind of a cool way to do it while at the same time respecting that tradition. And yeah,
how about some more music? This is Southern Texas.
Land down in Southern.
Love that song. You know, gosh, your voice. I mentioned you were an old soul at the top. I mean, you can hear it right there. You live in New York City, in Brooklyn, and you make this music that's got its roots in Appalachia, Kentucky, Tennessee, that sort of thing. You couldn't be further away from there culturally in New York City.
Right.
Does that sometimes feel weird to you?
Yeah, I mean, all the time. It's a big part of your identity, where you're from, for everyone. And culturally, this music is very centered around location, you know, although it was really played all over the United States at one point. And yeah, I think that being from Brooklyn, being from not the mountains, it's something that's really important to me, is visiting these places and learning about the music, and kind of, you know, if I'm going to play it and share it with people and record music, it doesn't really make sense to do that unless I have my own connection to it and also have a well-rounded knowledge of what exactly I'm playing.
Have you considered, as your sound evolves, have you considered taking the banjo into something with a more contemporary folk or Americana feel?
Yeah, for sure. That's something that I experiment with sometimes, and I definitely enjoy kind of seeing the banjo being taken to those places by other people. I don't know. It's a little bit of uncharted territory for me, and I feel like nervous in that area of musicianship. But it's fun to kind of learn contemporary tunes on the banjo, which I do sometimes.
Did any of that show up on this new album?
I'm going to say definitely not, but... Huh. You know,
well, that's okay. Now, listen, you're sticking to the tradition. And actually, I want to ask you about a song that's related to that, and a song that you considered not putting on the album because of its, frankly, its problematic racist history. You call this song Wade's Tune. That is not what it was originally called, but let's listen to a little bit of it. The original title of this was called Half Shaved, and then it also included the N-word. So, Nora, how did you grapple with putting a song like that on your album, and why did you decide to go ahead and do it?
Part of the reason that I put it on the record was to kind of create a space where I could kind of talk about how it's not just the songs with problematic titles, it's not just the songs that have offensive lyrics or words in them, it's the tradition in general, and we have to kind of acknowledge that a lot of this music was preserved by people who held racist beliefs. A lot of that music that we worship, you know, was played by racists. And that's something that I feel like it's a little bit looked over, like, oh, yeah, this is a safe tune, when there's no, like, offensive lyrics or obvious offensive history. It's a hard question. Can we, like, give these songs new lives by just changing the title? I don't really know. I don't know if changing the words can really solve the context that the songs were played in or anything like that. But I do know that despite this, the music does hold stories and history that is worth preserving. And we also have to remember that it's not a white tradition and it's not something that was just kept alive by white folks.
Well, in fact, the banjo has its original, its roots.
Yeah, the banjo is a great example. Right. The banjo is an African instrument, and a lot of old-time music, most of it, has African-American roots. And yeah, so I kind of felt like that would be a good place to kind of talk about that, with that tune kind of being the seed.
Well, it's tough stuff to grapple with at this stage of your career, at this stage of your life. But I do want to go back to your age for just a minute before we let you go. Because you have a gift, and you do have your entire life ahead of you. So, you know, what's your plan? Do you plan on being a musician for the rest of your life?
To be honest, I'm not sure. I definitely know I always want to play music, but is that my life career path? I plan on going to college and kind of learning some stuff. I'm interested in environmental activism and open to kind of anything, really.
Well, us old people are listening to you, envious of all the wonderful options you have ahead. We're going to go out on this song. It's called Will Davenport's Tune. You said it is one of your favorites. Just briefly tell me why, and then we'll hear it.
I just feel like it has this kind of nice simplicity to it, but I feel like it holds a musical complexity. But something about the rhythm and the way that the tune comes across is something that's really, really nice to play for me. And also, I feel like it's just something cool to listen to.
It is cool to listen to. 16-year-old banjo sensation Nora Brown, her third album, Long Time to Be Gone, it's out at the end of August. We'll link you to her NPR Tiny Desk concert at hereandnow.org. Nora Brown, congratulations. Thank you. We wish you a long career of just bringing down the house. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me.
In the Indianapolis suburb of Greenwood, people are grieving the losses from another mass shooting. A gunman killed three people and wounded two others at a mall yesterday before he was killed by a 22-year-old bystander who was legally armed. Greenwood Police Chief Jim Eisen praised the man who stopped the attack.
The real hero of the day is the citizen that was lawfully carrying a firearm in that food court and was able to stop this shooter almost as soon as he began.
Police did not release any information about a possible motive. Also, today in Florida, the sentencing trial begins for the gunman who killed 17 people at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School 4 years ago. Nicholas Cruz has already pleaded guilty to the murders. And as NPR's Greg Allen reports, the jury can either decide to give Cruz life in prison or the death penalty.
It was on Valentine's Day in 2018 that Cruz, a troubled former student, killed 14 students and three staff members at the high school in Parkland. He also severely wounded 17 others. He escaped from the scene by dropping his AR-15-style rifle and blending in with a crowd of students. He was captured shortly afterwards by police a few miles from the school. Tony Montalto's daughter Gina was one of the students killed that day. He believes the jury will agree with most of the victims' families that the death penalty is the appropriate sentence.
I think the facts that are available already show that this was a deliberate, calculated, and cold-hearted act. Let's remember he went back and shot Gina and the others again after he had shot them the first time.
The jury will weigh aggravating and mitigating factors in deciding whether Cruz is given the death penalty. Prosecutors will present evidence that the multiple murders were planned, and in legal jargon, especially heinous, atrocious, or cruel. The defense will present evidence that Cruz has severe developmental and mental health issues. The judge still has to decide how much of that testimony will be allowed into the trial. Phil Reisenstein is a defense attorney who's had many death penalty cases, but he's not involved in this trial. He says looming over these proceedings is the likelihood that should Cruz receive the death penalty, there will be an appeal.
I think you're going to see a judge be very open to much of what the defense wants to present, so that the appellate court can look at this and say, hey, you did everything you wanted to do. You got it all out there. The jurors heard what you wanted them to hear, and they made their decision, and we're not going to disturb it.
In pretrial motions, Judge Elizabeth Scherer has ruled that jurors will at some point tour the building at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School where the murders took place. Jurors will hear testimony from family members of those killed and from students who survived the rampage. They'll also view surveillance video from inside the school, as well as crime scene and autopsy photos of the victims. Defense attorneys say it's one of the toughest and most horrific death penalty cases they've ever seen in Florida. But Stephen Harper, a longtime public defender who's not involved in the trial, says a jury decision has to be unanimous so a life sentence is possible.
This case comes down to whether at least one juror will have empathy for the defendant's mental illness and mental capacities and mental problems. And if one juror can do that, then he will get life.
It took 3 months of questioning by the judge, prosecutors, and defense to select the 12-member jury and 10 alternates. The judges told them she expects the trial to run through October. Greg Allen, NPR News, Miami.
You know, a surprising number of people go to social media to get medical advice. And if that sounds like you, consider checking out Joelle Burvell's TikTok account. The Washington State University medical student is getting noticed on TikTok for sharing vital health information with the Black community. His videos get tens of thousands, sometimes even millions, of views. Here's one on skin cancer.
But here's the thing that's important for Black communities. There's a form of melanoma called acral-lentiginous melanoma. It's one of the least common types of melanoma, but the most common in African-American and Asian communities. It's typically found on the palms, on the bottom of your foot, on your nail beds, and can be mistaken as a bruise.
Let's meet the man behind the videos. Joelle Burvell joins me now. Joelle, hi.
Hey, thank you so much for having me here. I'm a huge fan.
Yeah, we're a fan of your videos, too. We're going to post them at hereandnow.org. But what inspired you to share that kind of medical information with the Black community in particular?
So I actually started sharing that kind of medical information about 2 years ago, halfway through my first year of medical school, where I was actually the first Black medical student at my school. So I was already feeling like a little bit of pressure to share my experiences as a Black man in medicine. I remember reflecting on things like the murder of Ahmaud Arbery. And at the time, he was the same age as I was. And then, of course, there was the George Floyd protests, which I participated in myself. And I think all those things made me want to use my voice. And I think the moment for me that allowed me to actually use my voice came one day when I was scrolling through Instagram and saw a study posted about these devices called pulse oximeters, which measure blood oxygen saturation levels. And researchers in the study had found that those devices overestimate oxygen saturation in Black patients. So in December of 2020, I posted a video about that on TikTok. But studies have shown that it doesn't treat all skin color equally. Because of differences in how the skin absorbs light, Black patients are more than 3 times as likely to have inaccurate, overestimated oxygen saturation levels compared to white patients. And that has clinical significance for COVID, since one of the main diagnostic criteria for COVID-19 is shortness of breath and low oxygen levels. And it ended up getting more than 500,000 views, and it was my first racial bias in medicine video where I specifically talked about issues that affected minority communities, particularly the Black community. And from there, I've just continued to share topics about health, the Black community, and medical history that I'm personally passionate about.
And we understand your message is getting through. Our colleagues at WHYY profiled you and pointed out that a woman saw your video on TikTok about melanoma and then had a suspicious lesion on her foot checked out. And it's a good thing she did because it was precancerous. So what are your thoughts on something like that and the kind of impact that you're having?
Yeah, sometimes it feels like I'm just sitting in my room, recording a video on my phone and just talking to no one. But whenever people like that reach out to me via direct message, or I mean, sometimes I've even been stopped in the street for people to tell me that my videos have changed the way they think about themselves or their interactions with the healthcare system. And truly, it just stops me in my tracks and it's humbling. Just a few months ago, one of my friends who's also a medical school student, she sent me their medical school syllabus, and my TikTok and Instagram were actually under their suggested resources list for the reproductive unit for understanding disparities in medicine. And so I think for me, it's just humbling to know that people are connecting with the content that I'm putting out there That's helping patients take control of their own health and hopefully helping future doctors as well understand how disparities come about and what we can do to mitigate them as well.
Well, what you just said leads me perfectly to this next video. This one is you explaining the way that racial bias in medicine can show up in a Lyme disease diagnosis.
Mm-hmm. Lyme disease is a bacterial infection that can be carried by ticks and cause a characteristic bullseye rash. But medical students are often taught to recognize what it looks like on white skin, not dark skin. See the difference?
And we couldn't see there, but in the video, the picture of the black skin, that bullseye target didn't show up nearly as clearly. So when you're in medical school taking classes mm-hmm. and that sort of thing, are people talking about the racial discrepancies in healthcare that are starting to become so clear and obvious?
I think people are starting to talk about them more. And I think partly it's because of COVID. COVID just unearthed so many health things, specifically in Black communities, that we're lacking. And I have a whole series called Dermatology Problems on Dark and Light Skin. And it goes through things like Lyme disease and eczema and psoriasis and shows how they can look different. And people in that video in particular love that series because dermatology is very visceral. It's something you can see, you can understand, you see it on your own skin. And when you aren't able to understand something on your own skin, you worry if other people have been trained to be able to also figure out what it is. And unfortunately, in many medical schools, that's not the case. There's been studies done that show that majority of textbooks don't have darker skin tones included in the images. But I think the education has to be done in a meaningful way that doesn't also perpetuate biases. So one example I like to use is sickle cell disease. It's a red blood cell disorder, but many times in medical school, we're primed to think of sickle cell as affecting mainly Black populations, when in fact it affects so many more people than that. And the reason why is because it's people that have ancestors that were in malaria endemic areas because sickle cell is protective against that get sickle cell. And that includes so much more than just Black populations. It includes any population that's in those areas. And so I think it really has to be done with nuance of understanding why these biases exist. How do we actually talk about them, about racial discrepancies? Because every single one is different. And then also, how do we educate people so that as physicians, we can really do a better job of treating patients?
You're doing all of this on TikTok, which is a place that's mostly known for where teens, you know, showing off their dance moves, or, you know, where Noodle the pug tells us if it's a bones or a no bones kind of a day, right? Like, do your instructors, yep. do they appreciate that you're trying to meet people where they are? Or are they kind of rolling their eyes at you and saying, like, this is not the way medicine is done?
Mm-hmm. I actually run a lot of my ideas by my supervisors, and I get a lot of ideas from them, too, about things to talk about. One of the doctors I worked with during my pediatric clinic during my third year in particular, she was absolutely incredible. And she knew I was passionate about healthcare in Black communities and would always teach me things about health disparities in the pediatric world that I otherwise would never have known about. And in turn, I would share those things on my TikTok for then hundreds of thousands of other people to also learn from. But studies show that 1 in 10 Americans actually turn to social media for their healthcare information. And so I think using an app like TikTok or Instagram or just any social media platform when it comes to talking about issues that have specifically targeted marginalized communities or communities whose stories have not been out there is important. Because many of these studies are important, but they're locked behind research paywalls. And so I think social media just allows for people to actually get access to the information that can help them take control of their own health.
Well, exactly. Because if people are going to social media for health information that could affect their very lives, mm-hmm. you better make sure they're getting good information, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Your videos have been so successful that you have caught the attention of some very powerful people. People in the White House, you visited the Surgeon General, Vivek Murthy, shot a few videos with him as well. What was that like?
That was truly surreal, yeah. And at first when I got the email about getting to do a TikTok with Surgeon General Vivek Murthy, I thought it was a mistake. Did not think it was meant for me at first because I really could never have imagined that I would start by posting on TikTok, would also one day be sharing health information with the Surgeon General of the United States by dancing to a song from Disney's Encanto. But Dr. Murthy does have some really, really great dance moves. So, I mean, I'm so grateful to have had this platform to spread this information because I think the more people that hear it, the better that we can start to address these health disparities that have impacted our country for so long.
Yeah, but social media can be such a toxic, hateful place. Do you? Mm-hmm. Do you experience any of that?
Yeah, I mean, I think everyone gets a fair share of the naysayers, of people saying, no, this isn't true, or like stay in your lane, or you're only a medical student, why are you doing that? And I think what I try and do is I focus on the people's lives that have been positively impacted, or the physicians and the nurses and the PAs who have reached out and told me your information has changed the way I provide care to my patients for the better. And I think those are the things that we have to do, because there will always be people that say negative things, but by focusing on the positive and seeing the changes that you are making, it keeps you going. So that's really what I focus on. I've been grateful to have so many people around me that have really shown me that this work is important, is needed, and has been missing for too long.
And as you keep going, what's next for you? What kind of doctor do you want to be?
Yeah, so right now I'm doing a research year at Johns Hopkins in orthopedic surgery. Orthopedic surgery is one of the fields that has actually the least diversity overall. I was really lucky when I was in college, I got to do an internship at Howard University Hospital with some amazing Black doctors. So for me, they inspired me so much, let me know that I could get here one day. And now I'm on this journey to be an orthopedic surgeon one day.
Well, congratulations, medical student and TikTok sensation, Joel Burvell. You can find him on TikTok at Joel Burvell, or go to our website, hereandnow.org. We'll link you to some of his work. Thanks for doing this.
Thank you so much.
The CDC has tracked at least 1,800 cases of monkeypox here in the U.S., and many health experts worry that we're running out of time now to contain this outbreak. Dr. Jay Varma joins us now. He's an epidemiologist and a professor at Weill Cornell Medical School. And Dr. Varma, first just remind us how monkeypox spreads and what the symptoms are.
So monkeypox is a virus that traditionally we thought of as only spread by close physical contact with somebody who has a skin rash. What's been unique about this outbreak is that it has been concentrated, and by concentrated, I mean over 99% of the cases have occurred in men who have sex with other men. And what's been notable about this outbreak is that people are first presenting with skin lesions in their genital area, strongly suggesting that this is either transmitted by that close skin-to-skin contact or even possibly by sexual fluids.
So if you're in this highest risk group, can you just give some advice on how people can potentially protect themselves or what they should do if they worry that they've been exposed or are showing symptoms?
This is a very tricky disease because there is a short period after you've gotten infected where you won't have any skin rash at all, and you may just feel kind of unwell, kind of like you have a flu, and that goes on for a few days. And then the first thing that you might notice would be some lesions, or what we call, you know, a skin rash that might be in and around your genital area or around your anal area. So the best advice we can give to men who have sex with other men is to, you know, first check your own body. Number two is if you have other partners you're going to be having sex with, ask them to do the same and double check. The next thing you can do is there is a vaccine that's becoming available. Now, it is in short supply right now. So you have to be in one of those areas like New York or LA where there's a lot more vaccine available. And that vaccine can be highly protective against getting this infection, but it takes two doses of the vaccine. So it takes up to 6 weeks after you've gotten that first dose to be fully protected.
Can you explain why there has been such a short supply of the vaccine and how long it will take before that problem is kind of fully fixed?
So the vaccine that we're recommending for people is a vaccine that is made currently by a company based in Denmark. And one of the reasons there's been a shortage of this vaccine is that U.S. federal government regulators from the FDA had not recently inspected the plant in Europe where this is made. So that process thankfully occurred, within the past 2 weeks. And so more vaccine is now coming into the United States. But it's really unfortunate because this is a vaccine that the U.S. had actually stockpiled for prevention of another disease, smallpox, but it also happens to be incredibly effective at preventing monkeypox.
It feels like there's also been a slowness to increasing testing capacity. The U.S. Department of Health and Human Services said that it recently increased testing capacity from about 6,000 to about 70,000 tests per week. Why has it taken so long to roll out testing in this way?
Well, this is an issue that I've been incredibly disappointed about the U.S. government response for. You know, I made reference earlier to smallpox, which is a virus that is officially considered eradicated from the earth, but there's always been a fear that somebody could synthesize it, or there might be a secret stockpile kept somewhere and a bioterrorist could use it. So because of that, the US did an incredible amount of work to stockpile and develop a test first for monkeypox, a vaccine, and even a drug to treat it. So labs around the United States had actually already been equipped with the testing capacity, about 70 labs that are part of a special kind of bioterrorism preparedness network. And what I had hoped to see is that as soon as, you know, U.S. public health officials had seen these outbreaks starting in Europe in early May, to really kind of ramp up and expand testing beyond these specialized labs. But for reasons that are unclear, the U.S. really didn't take a concerted effort to scale up that testing capacity until sometime in June. And it really hasn't been until the last 2 weeks that that testing is more widely available. And still, many healthcare providers are not really sure how to actually test somebody. So there's still a lot of work that has to get done to make sure that from a moment his patient is sick, they'll actually see a healthcare provider that'll actually be able to get them a test result quickly and get them the information they need.
Yeah, it feels like a lot of this just comes back to the slowness of bureaucracy. And I wonder, have we learned anything from the COVID-19 pandemic? I mean, do you feel like pandemic response in this country has gotten better to the level that it needs to, considering all of the missteps that you just kind of detailed?
This is really a demonstration of what we feared might happen, which is that, you know, the U.S. is so good at developing technologies, but that its public health system has gotten so atrophied over time that it doesn't know how to actually get people access to those technologies. What some of us had hoped for was that the stumbling during the COVID response, you know, was due to the well-told story of, you know, political interference and the desire at the federal government, you know, from the president and others to sort of pretend that COVID wasn't going to be a problem. But what we've seen with monkeypox is really a test case, right? That the U.S. had stockpiled tests, drugs, vaccines for prevention, yet kind of failed to alert itself and respond fast enough and to deliver the resources to people that need them quickly.
Dr. Jay Varma is an epidemiologist and a professor at Weill Cornell Medical School. Dr. Varma, thank you so much for breaking this all down for us.
Great. Thank you very much for having me.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Miles Parks in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd in Phoenix. This is Here and Now.